Welcome to Success Beneath the Surface, hosted by Deborah Fell, Managing Partner at Chief Outsiders. Deborah provides insights specifically for CEOs from growth-oriented companies.
Thank you, Susan. Hi, Alexi. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Deborah. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, you are Managing Director at DataArt, which is a global software engineering firm. You can tell us a little bit more about that in a moment. And I noticed that you've been there for over 27 years, so you must like it.
Either that, or I couldn't figure out anything better to do in all this time.
When we talk about, tell us where you started and how you got from there to here, that's quite a distance. So begin at the point, what made you come to this company, and then what made you obviously fall in love with it?
Well, I was part of the group that started the company. So I guess if we want to start with the beginning for me starts before DataArt was founded. And for me, sort of how I come to be part of this group all these years ago informs, I think, in large part, how DataArt evolved. So if interesting, I could give you a few comments about where I come from and why I ended up here. To keep it short, I grew up and lived until I was 16, at the very north of Russia, in a very inhospitable place beyond the polar circle, long nights, long winters, not a nice place.
Yeah.
It was very industrial, and engineering education was actually pretty good, or at least I thought so, because Russia, Soviet Union at the time needed engineers. And my dad, my mom were in the engineering field. I had an affinity for math, physics, and growing up in my early teenage years, I had this idea, later proven to be wrong, that I was really, really good at math. In my little town in the industrial north of the Soviet Union, I guess it was easy to be one of the best. And for the region, I was, well, high opinion of myself was quickly broken down, because at age of 16, I was invited to go to the specialized math and physics school, which was in St. Petersburg, one of the two capitals of Soviet Union and Russia, that was collecting this boarding school, which was quite unique in the Soviet Union, which was inviting what they considered talented kids from all over the country to live and study and finish high school. It was a boarding high school there. So I go there, I'm admitted, and I think I'm the king of this world, I'm the best. Of course, I show up at that school and I'm totally one of the worst. I had a little bit of brain, but I was surrounded by people who had way more brain and way more talent. That was a very good experience, and it was a lesson in humility that I think I carried with me. I was a big fish in a small pond. All of a sudden, I was a small fish in a very large and very smart pond. I've seen both, and I formed an opinion of which I like better.
Yes.
A little preview of what comes later. So long story short, I graduate from that high school. I get admitted into math department in St. Petersburg University. All good. I'm studying math. I'm okay at that. Roughly 4 years into my study, and at the time we had 5-year degrees, mm-hmm. and I realized there's no money in math. I'm not a genius, so I'll probably not be published in scientific journals for big money. So I have to do something else with my life. So last year of studies, I switched to computer science, and I started looking for a job in programming. I wasn't in love with programming. I didn't study it, and it wasn't something I did late at night. You know, I did prefer, you know, books and girls and beer and all of those things, but not computers. And then I went into computer science to make money. Be very honest here, maybe excessively honest. And I find not a job, but a contact who was trying to pull together a team of engineers for some internet project. This is year 97.
Okay.
And internet was getting started. And this group, a couple people were in New York, a couple people were in Russia at the time, let's do something together kind of thing. And somehow I get myself hired into that group, and they hire me as a programmer. Big mistake. I was terrible. They found me out in about 2 weeks. And I was discovered as a really, really terrible programmer, but I guess I was useful in other things. I could come up with ideas of what to do. I could speak with clients. There was no client at the time, but I could. It seemed like there would be at some point.
Yes.
And that was the beginning of DataArt, this group of about 5-6 people where everyone was much better than me with technology. And I was literally the only person who actually liked speaking with human beings.
Mm-hmm.
We're the founding group of DataArt. That's how we came together. For the first few years, I was still living in Russia. And in 2003, I moved here to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the second beginning of DataArt. 2003 was roughly when we realized we're not just a ragtag group of guys doing something, dabbling in internet project, but a big diversion around 2000 and some Eastern European focused internet projects. But this became a business.
Yes.
That was professional services, providing well-structured technology development services for clients in the US, UK, and beyond, roughly around 2003. So a little less than the total duration of the company.
So do you sort of remember that moment when it all dawned on the team of you that, wow, this is a business? And what caused that to be?
Interesting you ask that, because in the very late 90s and then the first few months of 2000s, it was very easy to feel your real business because money was easy. There was a flood of money streaming into anything that looked like internet or smelled like internet, or at least called itself internet. And there was so much money and so much interest that some of that money even ended up with total nobodies like us. So clients were relatively easy to acquire, and making money, feeling like you're a business was natural. So, and then it all crashed down. Those of us in the audience here, probably many are old enough to remember the big internet crash of the early 2000s. It all ended overnight.
Mm-hmm.
No clients, no money, no real business to
mm-hmm.
see. So there was a moment when we got together, this small group, and said, okay, what do we have? And at the time we had a team of about 40 people, money for about 2 months of payroll in the bank, no clients, no real understanding of what we are. And we had a choice, you know, do we split this money 40 ways and go in our own ways, or we try to make something else out of it? That was the moment when we decided that we actually can be the business. So it wasn't a company formation. It wasn't writing a business plan. It was not a strategy. We were far too young and inexperienced for any fancy things like that. But it was sort of this almost animal level decision. You get enough money to survive a month and go find a job, or you try to do something with the people you like and trust.
You know, as I listen to you, I hear from a very early age, you were raised in an environment, and I'm talking about a climate, that was probably very difficult for the average person to thrive in because of the cold, if for no other reason, but certainly the dark. You know, I lived in Sweden for a little bit, so I don't know that kind of cold and dark, but I do not know when it goes to almost 24 hours, and it's sort of, you have to really be within yourself, able to, you know, not just endure, but to continue to make things happen when it's dark most of the time.
It's a fair point, although you suffer from those things only if you know that there's better, only if you've experienced any different. When you live in it all your life, it's completely normal. So it would be unfair for me to say that I was suffering at the time and I was experiencing hardship, but not at all. Right now, I've been in New York for 20 years. We see some snowflakes on the ground. It's 0 degrees Celsius, 32 Fahrenheit. And I'm like a regular New Yorker, neurotic, like, oh my God, this is a terrible winter. And you know, back then this was summertime. So
yeah.
It's only in comparison. These things don't exist in absolutes.
Yeah, so true. And then you talk about a couple of pretty humbling experiences, and you laughed your way, you know, a bit through it in a very humble way. But I can imagine that when you first arrived at the private boarding school, that moment was rather crushing.
It was crushing, but not for long, because it was so interesting. That, I think, is one of my takeaways. I actually enjoyed studying with very smart people. And in that environment, you spend, I don't know, 90, 9% of the time actually studying and 1% comparing yourself to the others. The system worked that way. So yeah, I was a loser 1% of the time, and that was painful, but 99% I was just one of them in the classroom. That made it a lot easier. I have to give credit to our teachers and administrators of that school and other similar schools in that system. It was organized around this excitement of learning and tackling really complicated stuff at a young age together. And I think in that respect, education system that I grew in compares favorably to the one I'm looking at my own children that go to fancy schools here in Europe. It's different. Not necessarily worse, but it's different. And there's something about that system that created this general Eastern Central European education system that is so valuable in the tech scene today. In Datart, we continue to draw tech talent from that region, no longer Russia, but many other countries in the region that have similar education systems.
Yes, yes, that's great. And your curiosity obviously has fueled you, and I would imagine fuels you still. And then your ability to come into this team, form this business, realize your, and have everybody perhaps else also realize your computer programming is not your strength, but the curiosity plus the ability to just engage with people, which is probably in part fueled by your curiosity. Am I close?
I think so. I don't know why it works. Honestly, I think analyzing something that happened 25 years ago and, you know, with the weight of experience you have now, I'll probably sugarcoat it. Maybe my people who then I thought were gods in technology, now I call them my partners, maybe it was just clueless themselves, maybe they didn't know any better, whatever. It worked out. And I have to give them credit. The original founder of this group, this guy named Eugene Goland, who is still Datart's leader, he had this ability, continues to have it today, of placing bets with people, of trusting them to do the right thing. He trusted me for reasons I did not understand at the time. He saw something. All the credit goes to him. I don't think this is this stuff you can teach in a business school. It's somewhere in the gut. He certainly had it. If not for that gut, I certainly wouldn't be in the position I am today.
Yeah, and it's certainly all in the people. We can do a lot of things with machines, but we can't do the kinds of work that you're doing necessarily with machines. I also note that you, speaking of placing good bets, that you all are continuing that together, because the metric around your employees, you know, willingness to refer other people to come to work there is exceedingly high. It's something close to, or maybe even over 95%. That's astounding. What's fueling beyond employee longevity and loyalty, but their willingness to refer other people to come and work there?
I think this goes to the way the company was organized. And I'm mindful not to say the way we organized the company, which is, I mean, technically it is true, but I'm a little self-conscious to say that it was intelligent design, because I don't think it was, I think we were just doing what was natural. But looking back, it seemed like there are two fundamental ways to organize a company, system-based and culture-based. And the system, you know, you have a certain model of employee development or corporate decision-making, organization, managing, reporting line, accountability, all of those things that are, of course, very important. In a culture-based, you rely a lot more on informal ties between people, self-organizing groups, trust, certain freedom, and so on. And it was just more natural for us to build a culture-based organization. I'm not one to debate strategy versus culture versus organization and so on. All elements are important, especially if as you grow. And, you know, we were lucky for Datart to grow to almost 6,000 people. So, of course, you need structure and proper management. But culture was there first. And so I think a lot of people who joined us in the early days felt it in their bones, and they continued to infect others who joined them. It's harder now. I'll admit it. It's when we're making 700 hires per year, it's not so easy to ingest. If you're a new employee and you're put on the job, it's not so easy to ingest this stuff that I call culture during a month-long onboarding course. I can talk about it eloquently for an hour, but you've got to live it a couple of years before you feel it. So it's this chain of passing culture from one person to another needs time to fully work. And in business, you don't always have that time. So our employee loyalty metrics, recommendations remain very, very high, but naturally get a little worse over time as these chains just don't have enough time to work their way through. But we're quite proud that they remain very high for our industry, perhaps any industry. We're in people's business. We don't have any assets. Our assets, you switch off their computer every night, they may choose to leave any day, and then we're toast. So I don't think there's much of a choice in the matter.
CEOs need help growing their companies, but don't always have the time or money to hire a full-time chief marketing officer, CMO, or chief sales officer, CSO, or both. Recruiting a quality full-time executive can take months, not to mention the ongoing cost. In these challenging times, CEOs need battle-tested growth executives who can help companies successfully navigate the uncertain waters. Partner with Chief Outsider CMOs and CSOs who will function as strategic operators to build and execute your growth engines. And we're back.
You know, it's interesting the distinction you raise between, you know, what type of organization, because there was a period of time, and it may still be the case, but it seemed like a period of time where it was a constant reorganization for larger size companies, constantly restructuring. And sometimes that was, you know, in part for elimination of positions and so forth. But oftentimes it's like, well, things aren't working this way. Let's move all the boxes around and try it that way. And I've seen it lack success more often than I've seen it succeed, because there's fundamentally not a purpose that the employees are aligned with, or perhaps it is the culture that they are not aligned with. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a very interesting question, and for me, the thoughts that come to my head may be a little too abstract, but when I think about it, I compare organizations in my mind with athletes, and you can ingest some substance, prohibited or not, to give yourself a temporary energy boost.
Yes.
You feel less pain, you gain a little bit more endurance, and so on and so forth. In the short term, it is a performance booster. In the long term, these things don't work very well, and they can be harmful to your health. You know, there's no replacement. If you want to run a marathon, there's no replacement for running a lot. You know, no pill will make you a marathoner. I think organizations that go through reorg all the time, oftentimes, of course, do it for very reasonable reasons, to optimize business performance and so on. But oftentimes it is an attempt to give organization a boost of adrenaline or fear. Eliminating position is a very good motivator for those remaining to get their act together. Career aspirations are very good. All of those sometimes negative emotions are good short-term motivators. And I don't fault companies for going through that to find that boost of energy based on fear or ambition. Because sometimes companies and sometimes parts of my own company are just sleepy, and we all need to find that adrenaline. But it's rarely a long-term fix. In order to become a marathoner, you need to practice running. And in order to become a long-term functional organization, you need to practice things like that work long-term. Your culture, relationships, fundamentals of customer service, making sure that every person in the company lives and breathes what you are actually doing. How they are organized and who they report to, that's short-term adrenaline. What they actually do and how they think about the value they bring to client, to every last employee who joined yesterday, that's the long-term value. Easier said than done.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound like an oracle here. I wish this was easy stuff. It's not.
Yes. I think it's very powerful. And curiously, are you a marathoner or a runner?
Yes, those metaphors come from an important place. I am a runner. I've run quite a few marathons. And yes, I wish there was a pill that would make my training easier. Sadly, not.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about data art. What do you do? Who are your clients in terms of the types of clients you have? And let's learn a little bit about the company.
DataArt is a professional services company, and our service is helping clients put together custom technology. We fundamentally believe that for better business performance, using tech in a smart way, in a way that is often unique to the organization, is one of the key ingredients. And we help them put together that custom tech. We don't sell existing tech. We put together existing components, develop new stuff, find new ways to use technology in order to help clients boost their business performance. Sometimes it means redoing old systems on the new technology, moving them to cloud, building data platforms that to take advantage of the oceans of data they may be sitting on, might mean maybe building mobile apps to engage with their customers, building internal workflow tools to optimize and speed up decision-making process. There are a million places where custom technology is needed, and we do it all. We do it at some scale. We are now almost 6,000 people, so we have ability to do it for fairly large organizations. However, one of the defining characteristics of DataArt has always been this hunger. We'll take almost any business that comes our way. Small companies, small projects, large companies, large projects, anything in between. I hope none of your listeners here are our investors because they hate it. They justifiably want us to focus on the really, really strategic stuff. And I get this. And I'm trying to shift it that way. But historically, we would take just about anything. There's a lot of differences in the way technology is used across industries. Finance and healthcare, for example, are two highly regulated industries where a lot of technology requirements are driven by compliance yes. regime. Travel is very, very different. Media is very different. And so DataArt has worked out over the years these industry-specific strategies. There are five sectors that we are explicitly focused on, and we have dedicated groups going after each. So part of our strategy is not trying to become a household name in tech space overall. We're not that big and we're not that well known for that. But if you ask a CIO, chief technology officer in one of the sectors of knowledge, be it the travel or media, healthcare, finance for that matter, folks are much more likely to know us and respect us for the niche work that we do.
And so you know I have to ask the AI question. Certainly AI has been around for a very, very long time. And how would you respond to, you know, if I just ask, how is that evolving landscape affecting your business and your clients and how you do what you do?
The other side of the AI question is how it impacts our business. And obviously, generative AI, which burst on the scene about a year and a half ago, has huge potential and already a lot of evidence that it can write code. So we've done internal measurements, and it appears that in the right hands, AI does not replace an engineer, but it enhances a qualified engineer productivity. In our internal measurements and experiments, for some tasks, you can already save about 30% of the time. Mm-hmm. And that is significant, not life-changing, yes. but significant. And it means that for some projects, not all, and this is one of those things where you have to say, but still, yes. for some projects, they're becoming 30% cheaper, which is great news for yes. clients. Not so great for news for me if I think of my future as just mm-hmm. selling consulting hours. But the thing mm-hmm. is, the way economics of professional services work, in my opinion, is the lower the average cost of the project, the more stuff clients wants to do. Mm-hmm. There's always more ideas than dollars. Yes. And yes. if I can save my clients 30% or whatever the number is on the current project, it means for that 30%, I can do something else. And so those massive projects where armies of engineers are doing relatively straightforward, predictable work, much of that will be replaced by those productivity-enhancing AI robots. But at the same time, those engineers will be busy doing five different things, not one.
And as I recall, this was some time ago when we were speaking about your business, and I recall you saying that you were always also looking to ensure that your people had interesting work that they love to work on. Am I remembering correctly?
Exactly. Well, otherwise they walk out. There's no shortage of interesting tasks in the world. So it's very self-serving. It's not a sign of my charitable nature. It's very, very practical. If I don't supply that, they're gone.
But it's perfect because it in part explains, certainly in addition to your wonderful personality and great leadership style, it also explains your, 95% scores with employees, favorability and the willingness to refer and so forth, is that they have a place where they can come and do some pretty interesting work in their careers. And for reasons I don't understand, that is typically not a focus of companies' leaders, is to ensure that.
Well, it sort of goes counter to efficiency. Anyone in my position were focused on squeezing as much profit right this second, the right solution would be to charge a certain price to a client and then find absolute lowest cost resource to do the job. That would probably be very profitable in the short term, very destructive in the long term, because the client is likely to be left unhappy. So it's this continuous matching and rematching exercise. You have this flow of work, you have this supply of engineers that you have. How do we combine them into teams that will find it interesting, find it challenging, and yet will be cost efficient to solve this client problem? And it's not just the initial matching. That's, one-tenth of it. It's then creating an environment where things can change. One thing that is interesting for one person is terribly boring for another. The thing I was interested in 6 months ago, I may be tired of today, but these projects may be long. So we do have mechanisms at DataArt that allow, with some constraints, it's not a Wild West, but allow folks to change jobs inside DataArt, change what they do, reassemble in different teams. It's quite expensive, so it's not something that drives a lot of short-term efficiency. It's a conscious decision we made that helps long-term survival, I guess, or sustainability, but it's not cheap.
The value equation, if we made a formula, and with your math capabilities, we could probably create one. But I'm sort of thinking along the lines of, so often companies analyze an area, like, because we're spending money here and it's not cheap. But the fact of the matter is, in the total collective holistic view of the organization and hiring and rehiring and onboarding and all the expense associated with that, and the fact that what client doesn't want people who are working for them, who are excited about what they're doing, who are motivated by their company and leadership about. So it's got to also be a contributor to your client loyalty and your ability to get new clients. So one area of expense, and tell me if I'm off base, in some cases it is not relevant. It is, how is it impacting the total view of the corporation?
All of it is true. The thing that makes it all complicated is clients are not monolithic organizations. You take any large company, they've got business, they've got technology, compliance, architecture, security, procurement, and I'm just scratching the surface of the list of different interests in the organization. It's impossible to make everyone equally happy. And while it is true that when asked this question, do you want the absolute best team working on your task, anyone in their right mind will say, oh, yes, definitely. Next question, are you willing to pay for it? Or what are you willing to pay to make it happen? And now, what if that team needs to change? What seems like the right team today, month later, it's a different team. Are you willing to go through the pain and expense potentially of changing it? How does it fit with your sourcing strategy? How does it fit with your compliance environment, where those people may be spread out all over the world and you may have certain security limitations? So there's so many interests, and this finding a balance it almost never stops. It's many of our clients, and admittedly ourselves, are always searching for a winning formula. This is the way we do things. This is fixed. Let's go and repeat the pattern. But the reality is, we live in the world where these methods, these patterns, are worse than tomatoes. They go stale and rotten 2 days later, and they have to be changed constantly. And best results are achieved by customers and vendors who accept this idea that change is constant and they're willing to engage in that change. It's cheap and easy to say, yeah, change is constant. But are you actually willing to go through an effort of changing and the expense that is associated with it? That's the real test. There's no way back. This is the world we live in. We just spent a few minutes talking about AI. That thing will force us all change even faster than we have before. I was on the phone with a CIO client, fairly large financial services organization. The CIO was telling me, literally, I almost quote, "Remember what I told you last time we spoke, which was maybe 4 months ago. Forget all of that. You know, I now need to move 10 times faster on this." And that, what was important back then, is no longer important. I'm like, wait a second, we just made plans on this and this one. Forget it, it's a new world now. Yeah. That's the attitude that a lot of clients have to adopt, and a lot of suppliers have to be totally comfortable with it.
Yes, and I can't think of a better end note for this episode, because it's about change and how you manage and are managing many of the critical components, not the least of which certainly are clients, but also your own people, and how you lead with understanding that change, lead with curiosity, and lead with also seeking to fulfill the curiosities of your people so they can have great, enjoy what they do. Pretty powerful stuff, Alexei.
Thank you so much, Deborah, and you're very kind. I don't think we're doing anything extraordinary at all, but for us, it's important to do what we enjoy and hopefully help others do the same. But thank you for having me here. It's been a blast.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Be sure to subscribe in all your favorite podcast apps. Just look for Success Beneath the Surface. Chief Outsiders, part-time growth executives with full-time results.